Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today is Mackenzie Edwards from Cleveland & Crist in Austin. Mackenzie, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited.
Well, we're excited you're here. So for our listeners, just tell us a little bit about yourself, kind of your background. Just introduce yourself.
Sure. So I was born and raised in Midland, Odessa, and was a West Texas baby my whole life until I moved to Austin to go to UT for undergrad. And then I moved up north for law school immediately after I graduated and went to Northwestern in Chicago, which is where I graduated in 2019. Always knew I wanted to come back to Texas. So I immediately came back, took the July 2019 bar, and then started my clerkship with Justice Guzman at the Texas Supreme Court in September of 2019. Did that for a year. And then when that was done, I went to Bracewell in Houston for a couple of years and then moved to Austin and found this trial boutique, Cleveland Crist, which is where I work now.
And you mentioned your Supreme Court clerkship, and you happened to be there when some pretty significant things happened. I mean, the first one is that the first couple of episodes of the Texas Appellate Law Podcast got recorded there right during your clerkship, which is very exciting. Also, the day the bat got loose in the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
So you were there for those.
I was.
And then I guess there was also that COVID and ransomware stuff. How was that doing your clerkship during all that?
Sure. It was an interesting clerkship term. It had to be. So COVID, the court really went above and beyond to like make sure that we had resources we needed to keep getting the work done. There was a little bit of a learning curve right as it happened. The like remote technology to get into your computer, we didn't all use it very often. Everyone was very in person, work in the office, and like a couple of staff would work from home. But the most part, it wasn't really set up for all of us to do it. But within a couple of weeks, they really nailed it. We all had remote access. We weren't having really any technical glitches with it. As far as like conference goes, they found a virtual way to do that and to let the clerks participate, which speaking of a Supreme Court clerkship, I don't know if all of your listeners will know this, but it's one of the few clerkships where like when the justices have conference, the clerks get to participate. So that was an awesome part of it while it was in person and then something that they maintained as COVID was happening. So they did a really good job with that. But then, as you mentioned, a couple of weeks after the remote thing is finally settled, everyone's really kind of adjusted to working from home. We had the ransomware attack. So that at first I didn't really know if anything like completely out of the ordinary is going on because I thought it might just be like a glitch with the system getting into my computer. But my files are pretty meticulously organized and there was only one file in my main file folder. And it was that ransom note that NetWalker left for us with all of the affected devices. Like click on it. And it's like, I mean, I don't remember exactly what it said, but it was scary stuff. It was like, your blood pressure is definitely going up right now. Like you deserve to be scared for this. And like, it's going to cost you a lot of money to get it back. And I called my staff attorney and I was like, I don't know what's happening. And she was like, girl, it's not just you. So,
oh my gosh.
It was hectic sort of handling that.
So the cat was already out of the bag by the time you clicked on it, right? What you're not saying is that you're the one that caused the ransomware.
Oh, no. If I was that person, I don't think I would admit to it publicly.
That's
ever.
Fair. Totally fair.
Yeah. I can only imagine how scary that was. I mean, you know, as a new lawyer, you didn't even have your law license yet because you wouldn't have gotten your bar results yet.
The fun fact, yes. So bar results came out that October. This was also the clerkship term where they leaked a day early. So we got, I guess, like a couple hundred emails went out telling people that they'd passed, but they were supposed to go out the next day. They came out on a Thursday. They were supposed to go out on that Friday. And I don't think BLE was prepared for the accident. And we didn't know what was happening. So we ran to Justice Busby's office and like every clerk that had taken the Texas bar is like sitting on his floor. Like, what is going on? Tell us if we passed. When do we know? But yeah, so I did have my bar license. But still, I was a baby attorney and it's like, this is the state high court and this is a ransom note on my computer. What on earth? But all in all, they resolved it well. OCA deserves just all of the kudos in the world for the work they put in fixing that. And I mean, there were I mean, obviously some people lost some work. I think like 2 weeks of documents never got fully like saved. And so, I mean, that's a bummer, but everything else did. And they handled the backlog of things that they just did a really, really wonderful job.
It's really remarkable when you think about the volume of the court system that was impacted, that they were able to bring it back as quickly and as thoroughly as they did.
Oh, absolutely.
So you started practicing at kind of a weird time too. I mean, how was transitioning into practice from a clerkship in the middle of COVID, really?
It was definitely interesting. So my firm at the time was still letting us work remotely, and then they sort of gradually brought back in person. But one thing I will say is that as a young attorney, like working from home, having just graduated from law school, I was pretty used to being in my whatever area of my house I set up to study in and to get substantive work done. It was obviously law school work and not actual practice work, but it kind of just felt like the next step in that when I was sort of adjusting to COVID. And I think a lot of young attorneys sort of feel similarly, like we grew up with all of this technology. And so it's not as disruptive to some of our generation as to maybe some older practitioners who really like the in-person thing constantly. And I've really come to believe that like a part in office and a part in home setup, like a hybrid, probably a good path forward, probably what most people will end up doing soon, just because I mean, the proof of concept is the fact that, you know, all these law firms ran and worked so well, but there is obviously tons of value of being in the office. I will say at my current firm, this job, I love being around because the partners are really good mentors. So they come in and like talk to you about things, update you on cases or matters that you're not really on, check in on stuff. And so I like being at home and that wasn't as much of a huge adjustment for me, but I like being in the office too.
So you transitioned into a trial boutique. Did you know all along that you wanted to do trial work? Because you did an appellate clerkship, which it doesn't mean you don't do it. I'm just curious about your path.
So I originally thought that I wanted to do like a little bit of trial and a little bit of appellate. As I've sort of gotten into my practice, I do all civil trial and I do all criminal appellate, which is pretty unique sort of setup. But yeah, so for the most part, my firm does all trial work. We take in some really interesting cases. Almost all of our clients are like really invested in this. So it's not, sometimes we've had disinterested clients who just aren't as involved in the case. All of our clients really seem to care. It's a lot of really successful small businesses. We also take like a bunch of really interesting higher profile cases that are like a dollar short of the big law minimum, which means that we get some like, I mean, really meaty, really substantive, really, really fascinating cases that we get to litigate. That's been a blast. And credit to Karen Bledek for finding me this job because she was a recruiter. I'd moved to Austin. Bracewell was still a little bit in office and a little bit remote. So I was just Houston office located, but I was living in Austin. And I was like, I don't think this is going to hold very long. So I had gotten on Twitter and it was the day that Karen was like, hi, I'm switching to recruiting. And I didn't know her, but I'd followed her on Twitter for a while. And I was like, I really like what she has to say. And my biggest fear with getting a recruiter was like, I didn't want to be sold to the highest bidder. I wanted to find a place where I would fit and stay. And so I was like, I think she wouldn't be the kind of recruiter to do that to me. I think she'd be willing to work with me and find a place where I would be a good fit. That's sort of an unusual option for a recruiter. And she found me this firm and it could not have been a better fit. She did a great job. And I really owe a lot of this to Karen.
For most clients, a supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime. And very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today.
We like success stories like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And we always want to plug Karen, who, by the way, is one of our top 10 podcast downloads of all time. So, which is more than we can say for her husband, Steve, but I'm sure he'll catch up one day.
You know, we could have a whole conversation about that.
We should have them both on to do that. But yeah. So you mentioned, and one of the things that we really want to talk about today is that you do criminal appellate work, which is kind of an interesting thing that you don't see, particularly for someone who works at a civil trial boutique. How did you get into that niche?
It actually started while I was in law school. So they encourage, I think all law schools do, but Northwestern in particular encourages you to take the clinics for some hands-on practical experience. And I didn't know which one I wanted to do. So I went to like the clinic seminar thing where everyone presents them. And the professor of Northwestern's death penalty clinic, his name is Rob Owen, and we're probably going to talk about him a lot. He gave a presentation on one of the cases that the clinic was handling and just described a situation where I was like, I don't think that guy deserves to die. And I couldn't stop thinking about it. So I left the thing, had a friend with me, and he was like, that clinic seems interesting. I might take it. And I was like, I was thinking the same thing. And I thought I was going to do like an entrepreneurship clinic or maybe the Supreme Court clinic, but really couldn't get my mind off this one. So I joined the clinic and at the time was pro death penalty, like hadn't really thought about it. And I'm from Midland, Odessa. Like people talk about it like it's not even just like a thing that's accepted, a thing that's necessary. And I hadn't really interrogated my own beliefs about it. So I joined this clinic. I start learning the basics of what the death penalty system is and then the actual specifics of some of these cases, and just saw so much rot and so much breakdown in this that, again, I could not stop thinking about it. And I spent more time on this clinic than was even strictly speaking necessary, because I found it to be such important work. And then eventually when I graduated and I knew that I was going to be joining Bracewell and they gave us 100 pro bono hours. So I talked to Rob and was like, hey, I want to donate all of my pro bono hours to you, to these clients, to continue doing this work. Eventually Northwestern shut down that clinic. And so Rob went into private practice just as a solo practitioner. And he is where I get most of my, or was where I got most of my cases when I was immediately coming out of law school. It's he'd sub me in on the clients I'd had while I was in the clinic, but then also a couple new ones. And so that is sort of how I got started in all of this. As I've been practicing, I've met more people in the capital defense community. So I get referrals from them at, like, we talk about, we go to conferences to talk about the death penalty, or you get brought in to consult on a discrete issue for a client that someone else has. And that's sort of how I came to be where I'm at now.
So for people like Todd and I who have a kind of a basic understanding, but not a super deep one, can you just sort of describe the death penalty process, I guess, maybe from conviction beyond post-conviction writs, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, of course. Okay. So in Texas, a limited subset of murders qualify as a capital offense. And if you get charged with one, you're going into a completely unique criminal process. Death penalty trials are bifurcated. So there's a first phase that's the guilt innocence phase. And it's sort of the traditional, like what you imagine when you think of a criminal trial. And there's a second phase of the trial that just goes to sentencing. And that trial is unique in that a capital defendant is allowed to present, I mean, literally almost unlimited mitigating evidence to say, I do not deserve to die. There's some pretty standard forms of that. Like if you were young at the age of your offense, if you have mental disability, if you have evidence of like a particularly turbulent childhood or upbringing, education issues, things about your faith, things about your community, you can introduce basically any of it to try to convince a jury to give you a sentence less than death. At the end of the sentencing phase trial, the jury will ask or will answer three questions. The first is what we call the future dangerousness question. So it's basically, if you think that this defendant will commit future acts of violence and be a continuing threat to society, and the jury has to answer it yes or no. There's a second question that's only asked in some cases. So in Texas, you can be charged and convicted of a capital murder under the law of parties, so the felony murder rule. So essentially, you can be sentenced to death without having killed anybody. There's a second special issue question specifically for those defendants, basically saying, did this person know this murder or death might occur? Did they intend for it to occur? And if the jury answers that question, yes, then we go on to the third question, which is whether all of the mitigating evidence that was presented at the sentencing trial convinces this jury to sentence anything less than death. So if the first two questions are yes, or the first question, if there isn't a second, is yes. And the second question is no, it's an automatic death sentence. If we have the first two questions isn't yes, or the second question is the jury says that they found mitigating evidence or they think that there's been enough, then the defendant will get a life without parole sentence. So that is the sort of trial structure. Once you've been sentenced to death, you have an automatic...
Before we move on to appeal, I do have one question. So I understand that generally speaking, it's unconstitutional to execute someone who's intellectually disabled. Is that something that is decided sort of as a matter of law by the court? Is that a question for the jury? How does that play out?
So the mental disability thing is actually an ongoing, like, hot button issue in the death penalty system. The court has basically said that they want lower courts to do a holistic evaluation, like look at test results, have a doctor do the full evaluation of this person, figure out what their IQ is, and get some sort of concrete evidence of mental disability, and to have that be interrogated as some portion of the proceedings. The problem is that they haven't given actually concrete guidelines on what that's supposed to do. Texas in particular is very, very, very bad about disregarding mental disability evidence. They have, I think it's called the Briseño factors, I believe. So in these lower courts where defendants are saying that they're intellectually disabled, the Texas court is applying a list of factors that the Supreme Court has said, you don't get to do that anymore. There's just this whole wealth of confusion about what you're actually supposed to look for in this. A bunch of states are sort of enacting laws themselves to outline what those factors are based on medical evidence. Texas has tried to do that. There's been a couple, I think the last three or four sessions, representatives have been introducing legislation to do the same thing here, to sort of up our game on the intellectual disability questions, but it hasn't happened yet. I mean, pretty recently, the Supreme Court bench-slapped CCA for doing it again. And I think it was 2019 even. So it's not really a well-settled issue. And it really depends on what state you're in and a lot of other just sort of extraneous factors.
Okay. Sorry, I didn't mean to get you off where you were headed to appeals. I just thought that was a good place for that question.
Oh, totally. That's a particularly interesting topic of debate. But yeah, okay. So once a criminal defendant is sentenced, you have an appeal as of right up to the Texas Supreme Court. So we bypass the immediate appeal as of right to the Court of Criminal Appeals. And then if they affirm the sentence and the conviction, you get discretionary review to the Supreme Court. And if they deny that, you have sort of parallel options for next. You have post-conviction federal habeas review and then some state PCR avenues that you can pursue as well. So those are the things that'll happen next. And your rounds of appeals.
PCR.
Post-conviction relief.
Ah, gotcha. Okay.
We don't always do well with acronyms on this show.
I know. We're simple folk. That helps. So I know someone who just kind of follows this from the outside, but the AEDPA gets talked about a lot in death penalty cases. Can you kind of explain what that is and what role it plays in all of this?
Sure. So the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which we call AEDPA, sorry for another little acronym.
No, it's fine when you define it up front. We're good.
Yeah.
So AEDPA was a 1996 law that was enacted right after the Oklahoma City bombing with Timothy McVeigh. It erected a lot of procedural barriers to bringing to capital habeas proceedings, not even capital habeas proceedings, all habeas proceedings. I don't do other criminal work, so I'm less familiar with how it impacts. I know that it impacts a lot of criminal proceedings, but in the habeas context, it really forecloses the ability of a lot of capital defendants to raise legitimate and meritorious constitutional claims in federal court because there are just so many procedural hurdles that you have to jump. And then the Supreme Court has been repeatedly interpreting all of these rules in the most inflexible and unyielding way that it possibly can. So it just gets harder and harder and harder to actually litigate meritorious constitutional claims.
So you said there's parallel tracks. There's a state track and a federal track. Do you have to follow one or the other? Is it a choice? Is there an advantage or disadvantage going either direction?
It's definitely going to depend on the client in the case. So back to AEDPA for 1 second, there is a state exhaustion requirement. So if you have state claims that you can pursue, you need to be doing it in the trial court first. There are some ways that your federal habeas relief and your state post-conviction relief can happen at the same time. And you can have sort of those things going on at the same time. So yeah, it's really issue and defendant specific, whether or not you want to start initiating state or federal and when.
And that actually kind of leads into my next question, which is, what are the issues, state versus federal? What are the differences, the types of things that you can raise?
So there's a couple of things that AEDPA did that are particularly aggressive. The first is that there's a 1-year statute of limitations for you to be able to assert federal habeas relief, which is kind of ridiculous for a number of reasons. The first is that if you've got other proceedings going, it's unclear when the statute of limitations is told. And the Supreme Court has rejected federal habeas relief his attorney filed habeas papers 3 days after the deadline. And the Supreme Court said, sorry, you've waived habeas relief entirely. You will not get it. There's also a ton of other procedural, either court-made doctrines or other aspects of AEDPA that play into this 1-year statute of limitations and the tolling concerns. So courts often, they either can't tell or they have a huge struggle in figuring out whether a particular defendant in a particular case has brought their federal relief in a timely manner. And a bunch of cases, even some that are raising legitimate meritorious constitutional violations, get tossed because of this strict 1-year statute of limitations thing. And the second part of AEDPA that is, there's a lot of it that's wrong, but the worst part, I think, is there's section 2254, which says essentially, if the law at the time of the Supreme Court law that was clearly established at the time of your conviction is the only law that matters, and if the lower court's decision is not clearly unreasonable in applying that old law or new law, but it's usually old law, then there's no way for the federal court to give a prisoner relief. And there was one, I think it was out of California, because California still has a death row, even though they don't really use it. But this guy got a federal evidentiary hearing to bring some new evidence about things that went wrong in his trial. And the Supreme Court overturned it not despite the fact that the lower court had like refused to consider this evidence, but because of it, and said the state court record below didn't have this information. The federal court can't hear it. There's no habeas relief here. Sorry, bye. I don't think if you have legitimate evidence and you present it to a federal court that this constitutional violation took place, I think that that deserves to be heard. I mean, habeas corpus used to be called the Great Writ for a reason. It is there to protect our constitutional rights and to hold the government accountable. But AEDPA sort of vitiates that. It's a procedural labyrinth that's nearly impossible. Even practiced, skilled, long-time, full-time capital defense people really struggle to navigate around AEDPA. The federal courts are struggling to navigate around AEDPA. And essentially, at this point, it insulates state decisions from really any sort of federal review because there's just really no way. It is unlikely that you'll be able to successfully raise that on federal appeal.
Well, and in particular, where you have defense attorneys who are worried about potentially winning a trial or working about mitigating evidence and aren't necessarily worried about what's going to go in their writ applications long after the fact.
Oh, yeah. Also, I mean, evidence of innocence, evidence of constitutional violations, they come up sort of unpredictably and like, there should be a way for someone who has been sentenced to death or sentenced under any, you know, criminal statute to say this was wrong and this isn't okay. And I just don't think that any legislation or court doctrine that's sort of cabining in that, I don't think that's justice.
Providing surety bonds for court-related matters is a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Court Surety Bond Agency. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA uses its more than 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds to provide first-class service to its clients. For more information, visit courtsurety.com.
And particularly as we've seen things like increase in scientific accuracy and junk science getting thrown out, and people don't find out until decades after they're convicted that, oh, by the way, everything that you're in here on is bogus evidence.
Sure. So when the Oklahoma City bombing happened, it sort of came after a couple years of there being some discussion throughout sort of the legal field that maybe death penalty appeals were taking too long, because there are a bunch of constitutional issues that are litigated on that. So there were a bunch of appeals. The process was taking longer and longer, and there was some sort of frustration with that. It was also the sort of tough on crime era. So people were like, okay, let's make this faster. You know, you should get review, but we should get this over with. This should be done. When the Oklahoma City bombing happened, people really kind of acted more out of sort of fear than maybe great legislative principles. And AEDPA was sort of born out of this misconceived notion that we must streamline these appeals and we must, and I don't disagree that we shouldn't be leaving people on death row for decades. I think that that's wrong, but I don't think that that means that we need to be sacrificing constitutional protections. And honestly, Congress and Bill Clinton, who was president and signed it into law, they said the same thing. If you look through the legislative history and the debate on AEDPA, and even Bill Clinton's signing statement said, this will help, you know, make the death penalty faster while preserving independent federal review of these claims. And then the courts have sort of not actually been able to make that second part true because there isn't independent review anymore. It's so incredibly restricted that it's very tough to get.
Seeing the phrase effective death penalty in the title of a federal statute is a fairly chilling thing, honestly.
I don't know. AEDPA's effects will be felt until the statute is repealed or made substantially better. But it hasn't streamlined appeals. It hasn't made things faster. Sometimes courts hold onto these cases for longer than they have to, even frivolous ones, because they have to solve the procedural stuff before they can issue anything about the merits. I think there was a study that was fairly recent. I want to say like 2016-ish, that went back and looked. They looked at all of the pre 1976 death penalty, sorry, not 1976, 1996 death penalty convictions and habeas proceedings, and found that like 40% of them, the federal habeas proceedings were successful. And after AEDPA was enacted, I think that number is down to like 12%. And if you're in the 4th, 5th, and 11th circuits, it's like less than 2. That actually probably just goes to the fact that I don't think we're applying the death penalty in a way that's sort of consistent or that really meets the constitutional standard anyway. But that's sort of one of those things where like, okay, so in one of these circuits, you're less likely to get EDPA relief, even if you deserve it. That's not really a great way to do justice either.
I do want to talk a little bit about the issues with the application, because you mentioned that it's not applied consistently. I mean, when you say that, what do you mean?
A couple things. So there's racial considerations across the board, but the most important one is actually the race of the victim. So if you, across races of a capital defendant, if your victim is white, you are more likely to be sentenced to death. It's also a matter of geography. So for one thing, we have, you know, only limited number of states that actually have a death penalty or that maintain a death row. I think right now there's 27 states that like have death penalty statutes. Five of them have governor imposed moratoria right now, so they're not actually killing anybody. And then two of them don't actually have an active death row. So essentially there's really only 21 jurisdictions that'll have it. That seems like an inconsistent application in and of itself. But if you're in one of the unluckier states, Texas being one of those, you're more likely to be sentenced to death by the state, because not only because your state has it, but because your state likes it. There was a study recently that said like the closer you are to Harris County when you kill somebody is the more likely you will be killed by the state. I don't think that's great either. I don't think we should be. I just don't think that should work.
And that was another question I had is, you know, even within Texas, I think there are some sort of county level statistics that there are certain counties where you're disproportionately higher going to be encountering the death penalty as a defendant.
Yeah, Harris County is number one. In fact, so Harris County in and of itself kills more people than any other death penalty state. So Houston, more than any other death penalty state. It also kills two times as many people as Dallas County, which is the number two county of that.
That's very sobering. Those are sobering numbers.
It is.
And a lot of stuff is sobering information, because it's not really known. Like a lot of people, no one really interacts with the death penalty until they have to. So a lot of people just don't know this. They assume the death penalty goes to the worst of the worst. It's applied even-handedly. The rules are always followed. The procedure is sound. Courts can review it. It saves us money. Like none of those things are really true. I mean, some of them are, but it doesn't save us money. It's not any faster. There's a lot of preconceived notions about the death penalty that people have that just, they don't hold up to reality.
And you're right. I mean, it is something that people don't want to talk about and try not to talk about as much as you can, because it is very uncomfortable just on the basic philosophical level. And of course, as Todd and I know, because we've based our entire careers on it, courts do make mistakes.
I'm a lot of fun at parties when I just randomly bring these.
Who wants to talk about the death penalty? Yeah, I can see.
You need a button, you know, ask me about EDPA.
I have an abolished EDPA cup, actually, which I should have brought today and drank while you're doing this.
Do people actually try to defend the death penalty based on cost savings? I mean, I heard you say that, oh, it doesn't save us money. Well, okay. What's the rationale there?
It's actually the number one thing that people, when they talk to me about death penalty stuff and they support it, will say as their defense is, we shouldn't be paying to house somebody for life if they've killed someone and they're dangerous. It's three times more expensive in Texas for a defendant to be sentenced to death rather than life. So if cost savings is really what you're going for in your defense, you're kind of losing it on that point alone. And that doesn't even necessarily take in all of the extra security costs. You're on death row in solitary confinement and you have to be taken everywhere by a guard. So there's more staffing costs. Transportation costs are higher. Lethal injections, when you can even get them, are like $1,300 per prisoner. So we're wasting a lot of money on this. I think, let's see, a couple of states have spent upwards of like $300 million to execute less than 150 people. I think it's like North Carolina and maybe Ohio or Idaho. Some of these states are spending just an outrageous sum of money on a system that really, if you start talking to people about the death penalty and you sort of really dig into it, people are squishy about it, even if they say that they're in support of it. We're spending a lot of money on a thing that it doesn't really seem that the public really wants. Not every state has it. Public opinion actually is at historic lows right now for the death penalty. So that's an interesting consideration too.
Hmm. Again, all very sobering thoughts and statistics, but to try to shine a little glimmer of hope into doing the kind of work that you're volunteering your time to do. What areas in doing the kind of work you're doing on this pro bono death penalty work, what areas stand some chance of success in light of all the hurdles that you've you've mentioned, because I mean, there were hurdles, it seems, before AEDPA was ever enacted. And now AEDPA, as you've explained, has made it even more difficult. What are the areas in which folks who are volunteering their time, like you are in these cases, can get excited about the chance of actually, you know, making that difference of helping someone get relief from a death row sentence?
One area that's sort of a glimmer of hope like this is the capital integrity units that are coming around in Texas. Not every county has them, but it helps a lot with actual innocence claims, and it helps a little bit with other constitutional violations. But I have a client whose case is with the capital integrity unit right now, investigating a shaken baby syndrome claim. When you get the capital integrity unit involved and the DA's office is helping and sort of working on this thing together, there's less county level objections to it. And you can sort of find a way to get a new sentencing trial for someone who deserves one without having to go through the higher level rigmarole. And then a lot of cases having to do with mitigating evidence that was presented during a sentencing phase, those have found some success because the court has said in the last 20 years, anything, you can give us anything, anything that might convince a jury to give you mercy. The jury not only has to hear it, they have to know that they can apply it. So there's been a lot of changes in state law that were sort of talking about how to introduce mitigating evidence, and some of them didn't really meet constitutional muster. So those cases end up with some success because you can argue the jury wasn't able to consider this wealth of mitigating evidence that suggested that I didn't deserve to die. And there's a way for that to actually be adjudicated because we've had this wealth of, it's Penry claims are what they're called. And Penry claims, there's been a lot of success there too.
Good. I was just starting to wonder, it's like, it would seem like it would be a noble cause, regardless of any real prospect for success, but that you'd have to have some level of hope that you're going to be making a difference. Maybe the battle, you know, fighting against the AEDPA machine is its own reward. I don't know.
One thing that's rewarding, sort of regardless of outcome, is that you get to interact with your client and spend some time with them. And like, they really enjoy being treated as people and getting to have a visitor and having someone to write to. And when you're also their attorney, it's also like, hey, this minor prison thing happened to me and it's not okay, but like my grievance procedure isn't done. Is there anything you can do to help? Because yes, there is. I can go down to the prison and I can go talk to some people. And that being able to sort of help them in small ways, like I really, really care about my guys. And so being able to sort of do instantaneously, but this is pretty new. So this was a couple of years ago, it was 2021, and there was not sort of a way for my client to sort of send me information all at once. So I needed him to get me some documents, told him ahead of time, he prepped it, put it in a folder, gave it to the guard to give to me. But when he hands it, and to back up a little bit, prison visitation for death row is non-contact. So it's like over the glass, you pick up the phone and you have no actual ability to, like, you can't touch the guy, you're in technically separate rooms. So he handed it to the guard to walk over to me, and she started flipping through it. And she goes, these aren't legal papers. I'm going to take them now. They're now state property. So he's getting upset. I am literally like banging on the glass, pick up the phone, say exactly what I say to her and sent to, when I say it to you, you're going to say it to her and then you're going to send her to me. So basically had that guard walk over to me and had to give an oral argument to a law enforcement officer being like, this is legal. These are legal papers. I need them. You as a state actor do not get them. And I'm going to make this your problem if you don't hand them to me. So that was the last time I was there. I'm sending other people currently because I don't think they like me very much after that incident. I had a meeting with TDCJ, like upper levels, that involved talking about this. But yeah, so I do get to go every so often. I do need to plan a next visit. And yeah.
Wow.
One thing I want to talk about when you're kind of talking about all of this that I think is a misconception is if you prevail in a habeas, it doesn't mean your client walks out the door.
Correct. The way that it works most of the time is that you'll either get a new sentencing trial where you might get the death penalty again, or you might get a life sentence. More often than not, it's just a sentence just gets reduced to life without the need for a second trial. But under no circumstances are any of these guys walking out into free society again. It's not really an option. The current Texas law has life without parole or death. Those are your options. Now, some capital defendants who were sentenced before that update, before Texas enacted life without parole, could technically get life and be eligible like to get paroled out. But those are few and far between because, I mean, just not enough guys were convicted long enough ago for that to really apply to them. But yeah, if you get relief, you're not leaving prison. You just aren't going to be killed by the state.
Where in the process do you come in? I mean, what is the work that you do?
So I have been spending most of my time right now on some state habeas petitions. And then we recently had a case that we brought to the Supreme Court on a direct appeal. But basically, I'm sort of a pinch hitter for whichever aspect of my client's cases is sort of happening at the moment. And I don't proclaim to be an expert on like much of this stuff. I know the things that I know when I get thrown into the situation and then learn as much as I can about it. But it's a pinch hitter is really the best way that I can sort of describe it. I play roles as I'm needed as the cases are moving forward.
Is it typically post-direct appeal or is some of a direct appeal as well?
I recently had a direct appeal, but most of my work is post-conviction.
One of your clients that's been in the news recently that you mentioned me that I didn't actually know about is Gabriel Hall, which is an interesting case. To the extent you can, do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, of course. Gabe was in Brazos County Jail and Comedy Central and Jeff Ross wanted to do a prison roast. So they like sent out a request to all of the American Jail Association or something asking if any jail wanted to host it. Brazos County was the only one that said yes. So they brought Jeff Ross in. They encouraged all the inmates to participate. They didn't tell their counsel, didn't tell anybody to check with counsel. And Gabe had an attorney at the time, had not gone to trial on his capital charge yet, had a no contact directive from his attorney to the state. When Jeff Ross came in, they let the staff like escorted him around, but they let him talk to inmates with staff supervision. And Jeff Ross walked up to my client while he was eating lunch and then started ribbing him as a comedian does. And there's a 17-minute long video of my client where he doesn't cry about his crime and is asked about it. The comedian asked a joke about it and my client responded to it. And there's a couple other things that are, you know, there was a couple of racial comments made about him. There's also a bunch of other guys around. So everyone's trying to act tough and cool in front of Jeff Ross. And as soon as the interview's over, the quartermaster runs straight to the warden and goes, "They just got Gabriel Hall on footage. Yay, we need it." They subpoena the footage from Comedy Central and they're like, "Hey, we're going to give it to the state and we're going to give it to the defense." And they only gave it to the state. So Gabe's attorneys found out about it super late, like on the eve of a hearing, tried to get it excluded. That did not work. And now at the sentencing trial, the state used video of my client like engaging in a joking situation with a literal comedian to say, "This guy's not sorry. He deserves to die. Look at him. He's making light of it. So he doesn't deserve mercy." And that's what we took up to the Supreme Court was, hey, this is a state actor, essentially, because you let him do state functions. You encouraged all of these inmates to participate, despite the fact that my client had a directive saying, "Don't talk to him without me." No one is saying that like this prison roast shouldn't have happened. Whether it's advisable is a whole other thing. But I'm not saying we shouldn't do special things for inmates. What I am saying is the best thing to do would have just been to let him talk to his counsel, give them a meaningful opportunity to advise him about like, hey, if you participate, the state might be able to use things that you say to kill you. And none of that happened for Gabe. But unfortunately, the Supreme Court did not grant cert. So we are working now on some state post-conviction relief for him too.
It's one of those fact patterns. I can imagine you just see some absolutely crazy fact patterns.
That's putting it mildly.
Can only imagine. Have you had any benefit? We talk a lot on this show, we've talked about, and generally among the appellate bar, about pro bono work being a good opportunity for young lawyers to get, say, not only good brief writing experience, but also potentially oral argument experience. Has that come to pass for you? Have you had much courtroom work that's come out of this, or is it mostly on the papers?
For the pro bono stuff, it's mostly on the papers, but that's a feature sort of how my pro bono situation is structured. I do know a lot of people that do pro bono work through Legal Lines, or I think it's Texas Appleseed, maybe one of them too. But there are a bunch of organizations that will help connect young attorneys to these opportunities. And I know that a lot of those encourage attorneys to get some stand-up courtroom experience through this stuff. And there's a bunch of areas of law where you can do this pro bono work as well. Also, if you are so inclined and you have a passion project or a thing that you're willing to work on for free, just go talk to your firms about whether or not they'll let you build that in. So then you can sort of make your own stand-up opportunities if you want to. But I really do have to credit my firm for its commitment to my pro bono work because I do a lot. I spend a lot of hours doing it. And my boss is essentially like, you can do as much of it as you want, as long as it doesn't interfere with your work for us. We encourage you to keep doing your pro bono work, to keep your active death row docket. And so having the support of my partners is really great. But I'm sort of at least one case study. And if you really want to do a pro bono thing, you can get your firm on board and then you get to do it.
Well, it's really neat. I mean, the way that you managed to turn the Bracewell 100 hours of pro bono into that specialty and then carry that forward when you change firms. I think that says a lot about both firms, honestly, but being able to carry that into a new position and having that attitude from the folks you work with, I think that's really cool.
I agree. It's pretty cool.
And one thing I want to make sure people appreciate why we're putting this in the pro bono context is you get appointed counsel during your trial and direct appeal. And then after that, they're on their own. So all of this post-conviction stuff is either out of pocket for somebody or pro bono.
Well, you do actually in Texas have a right to counsel for your post-conviction proceedings. I think it's Article 11.071. So it's only, if you've been sentenced to death. So your habeas proceedings, you do have a right to counsel. The thing is, though, if you're getting an appointed attorney, they might not have the resources or the time to really dig into the like developing a factual issue or uncovering a constitutional claim. So being able to have pro bono people that like that care about the issue, or the law school clinics too, University of Texas and University of Houston in particular have some really good clinics that are doing this that just encourage people to spend time, dig through this record, do outside research, see if there's anything we can do to help this person in this situation. And that's kind of the requirement that's needed. It takes hundreds of hours to do the post-conviction work. I've never been in a capital trial, but I've read some numbers on how much time that takes too. And then even clemency proceedings take hundreds of hours. It's something that, you know, if we had a better funded system for defending some of this stuff, it would take a lot of the rot sort of out of it. But for now, having people donate their time and sort of help on this issue, it's really incredibly meaningful to all the people that you're helping.
If someone is interested in getting into death penalty or post-conviction type work, I mean, where would they go to look for that?
There's a couple of organizations in Texas that would be probably a good start. Texas Defender Service, Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. There's a couple of capital habeas units. All of them need help, whether it's legal or advocacy work. And going to them and asking sort of, hey, I'm around. I'm interested. What can I do? What do you need? We'll get you some of the way there. And then just go talk to practitioners. If anybody wants to reach out to me, I would be happy to point you in that direction. I'm pretty limited to the Texas knowledge base because all of my clients are here now. I had two clients on federal death row and don't anymore. So I'm pretty Texas focused, but I know of people that I've got a good friend of mine who's essentially me, but she's in Florida, got a couple of counterparts in Virginia, DC, a couple other states that still have them. So just getting in touch with someone who's in this community will get you some of that information too. And everyone really wants, like, if anybody's interested in helping, we want to bring you on board. We want you on side. So really reaching out to almost anybody in this industry will probably give you some starting ground for that.
And I guess kind of my last substantive question before we wrap up is, what was it that sort of changed your perspective about this? I mean, I know you came from a place that was sort of pro-death penalty and that was your view. What was the tipping point, or was there a tipping point rather than just sort of the whole thing in slow progression?
I honestly think the best way to describe it is the whole thing in slow progression. I grappled with my feelings and thoughts on the death penalty throughout my whole time at the Northwestern Clinic, where I was like, okay, I support the death penalty, but like maybe not in this circumstance. Maybe we should change this aspect of procedure and maybe that would make it better for me. And it got to the point where trial discrepancies are numerous and abundant in these problems. Conditions of confinement are a thing that I'm not okay with. The lethal injection protocol and there's a bunch of issues with all of the available methods of execution. And it's just that there are so many discrete broken parts that I got to the point where it's like, fixing even most of them doesn't get me where I feel comfortable letting the state kill people with my dollars and in my name. I think there's just too much to fix. You'd have to burn the system to the ground for me to be okay with it. And so that was sort of, as I got to that point where I was like, I don't support it for this. I don't support it here. I don't support it how. It all just sort of came to be that by the time it was like the middle of my 3L year, and my professor asked, he was like, do you still support the death penalty? I'm curious. Because I think I was one of the first people in the clinic ever to come in and say on the first day, oh yeah, I support it. I'm just interested in this thing. And so he asked me sort of towards the end, like, is that still true? And I was like, absolutely not. You did a really good job of not only like teaching us how it works, like showing us this is how it should work. This is how it was applied. And that's what really got me over it. And so, yeah, I would say sometime at the end of my 3L year is when I knew, but it was before then, the slow progression the whole way that really put it over the top.
Well, Mackenzie, this has been very interesting, fascinating, really, to hear about. And I think I can speak for Jody when I say I applaud you for what you're doing, your dedication to it. I think it's a great example to other young lawyers on, you know, how to find something that's yours and do something that your firm can encourage and get behind that does contribute in a significant way to pro bono efforts for people that really do need it. But thanks for being with us. And I know you know, because you've listened to our show before, as you said before we started recording, that we like to ask our guests as we're getting ready to part for a tip or a war story to kind of cap us off. So do you have something that you'd like to share?
I'll give a tip. So I have not the most efficient typing fingers. I will sometimes mean to type a word and I will type the same wrong word instead of that word every time. So I have like a list of words that I commonly mistype. And I run as part of my like final site checking process, I do control Fs for those and like check to make sure that the right word is there. So if you like me, sometimes struggle with some of that stuff, a word list is very helpful. I also have like a list of my partner's preferences on things. Like one loves like two spaces after a period. One absolutely refuses to file anything with the title of the document underlined. One really likes to have draft on the signature block while we're drafting. And one is just like, no, just type my name there. Who cares? So having a list of like, these are the preferences for each of these people is helpful, because then as an associate, part of your job is to make your boss happy. Your boss is also your client. So having sort of a cheat sheet for like making sure that these formatting or like very tiny minor things that your partner likes are done in a certain document has served me very well.
Those are great tips.
Yeah. I may borrow the commonly mistyped words.
100%, because there's 5 or 10 that every single time I mess it up and I know what it is in my brain and my fingers cannot connect with it.
I have so many of them and they're weird words and like they come up, and it's having a list is very helpful.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, thanks very much for being with us.
Yep.
Thanks for having me on. I really can't tell you how much I enjoyed sort of talking about this issue at all, but introducing it to people who might hear some of this stuff for the first time and possibly be interested in it or look it up more or have their minds changed. This is a really sort of unique and awesome opportunity to like get to talk to a bunch of people about this issue I care about a lot. So seriously, guys, thank you so much for having me on.
No, I'm really glad I learned a lot. And Mackenzie said she likes appellate trivia. So I just have 5 questions about the Galveston Court of Appeals before we go.
Let's go.
I'm kidding.
I was about to say, I do not have any Galveston Court of Appeals knowledge. I'm very, very sorry.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess you're not going to win the gift card. Sorry.
Ah, dang it.
I was looking forward to that. Oh, well.
We really appreciate it.
We sure do.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.